Everybody will come to order 5 minutes after the modified scheduled time. I apologize for that. First item on our agenda that we're going to address is House Bill 2210, work session on House Bill 2210, which will open. Colleagues, we don't have the amendments that we need on this bill, so the opening of the work session today is for the purpose of hearing from Brian Daugherty and Thomas Endicott and others who may want to be heard, because we cut them off at the public hearing. We never finished the public hearing. So, Brian, would you come forward first, please? And then others who may want to be heard, we'll hear those, and then we'll move on to our public hearing. Yeah, maybe. We'll see.
Good morning, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. My name is Brian Daugherty. I'm here testifying on behalf of the Western States Petroleum Association on House Bill 2210, and I appreciate, Chair Barnhart, you have a lot to do today, and I have tried to make brief four suggestions that I think we should look at in this bill. It has to do, obviously, with the biofuels component and dealing with issues, I think, that are directly before your committee. The first item I'm talking about is looking at sunsets on the renewable standards that you have. You have sunsets on the incentives portions of the bill, and I think, like incentives, sunsets are a market manipulation that you do, and I think primarily what we've heard in the committees and in the interim committees was this is something to help a fledgling industry get going. I put a date of December 31st, 2012, which is the day before all the sunsets on the incentives go away, and I think it's a good time for the group to come back to you to see if the mandate still is appropriate to continue in this manner. And I put the in the paragraph on item one just below, I insert it in two places because you have two renewable standards, one for biofuels and one for biodiesel and one for ethanol. And I think, again, this would be prudent of the committee to look at this to see what the effect is. I have some amendments to the study also, which I think will help you when you look at this again to determine if, in fact, it's working as it should and whether this fledgling industry is now off and running and is no longer in need of a mandate. The second item I've listed is an amendment to the job impact study that I mentioned. What that study is in Section 9A talks about having now it'll be the Department of Energy giving you a biennial report on the job impacts from this legislation. What I would like to add is other issues such as determining the number of acres of biofuels feedstock planted, the fuel costs related to the legislation, fossil fuel reductions, number of biofuel gallons produced and consumed in Oregon, and the environmental impacts of this legislation. I think those would all be relevant to folks that are looking at this, and I've talked with the Department of Energy. They felt that this is information they probably could get for you as part of the impact study.
I'm getting a nod from Mr. Graney.
Item three talks about an issue that may be able to be taken up by rule from the Department of Agriculture. But what we want to have is there's an issue regarding how we're going to get the exact information regarding B100 fuel quality or other things. And what we're seeing in other states is there's some issues where we might get a certificate of analysis that's 3 months old for a batch that's coming into our plant, and they say, well, that's good for anything else that we've produced in the last 3 months. We want to make sure that we understand that they need to have up-to-date certificates of analysis that come down to us at the terminals where we're splash blending the product. The fourth item is one that I've taken from the Washington biofuel standards, and that is to give the power to the governor in case of market disruption or something that happens, the power to suspend temporarily the renewable fuel standards in either one. And there's issues that have happened in Minnesota and other places where without that you'd have to call a special session if in fact we had issues that could relate either to fuel quality, fuel pricing, or fuel availability of these additives. A mandate requires you to get this 24/7 no matter what, and giving the governor the power to have a temporary suspension I think is prudent. And that is the language from the Washington legislation similar to this. And with that, I'd be glad to answer any questions that the committee may have.
Thank you very much. Questions? Yes, at the end, Representative Grant.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you give me a little more detail on the executive? The governor using executive order. I mean, give me an example. You alluded to it briefly, but an example of where this might arise. And how do you? And then the wording here is sort of open ended. When you say a minimum time, how do we define that?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Brew, I would think you could look at something like the price gouging legislation that talks about fixed focus and geographic and time area, and you could have something that says they shall be for 30 days or unless the governor renews the order. This is the language I've had here. I was trying to get something that would allow people to determine when it happens. Let me give you an example of when it would have been useful in Minnesota when they had this. They had essentially a gel problem with it, a cold flow, and they had a bunch of trucks all parked along the roads where their engines wouldn't run because of the problem with the biodiesel. They didn't have any way of turning this off, and they had to go into a special session to suspend it, and they suspended it on two occasions. So that's the idea, is that someone could do something if you have a significant market disruption. I'm not talking about something in general, but where we really see we have a problem. We've got to meet the law by continuing to put that product into the market when we may have a problem, particularly with some of these young fuels that we don't have a lot of experience with.
Thank you. Representative Berger.
That was essentially my question, an example of why that would be applicable, and I think he's brought forth a very good example.
And I do recall in the earlier discussion that Representative Butler raised similar concerns. Other questions? Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. Mr. Endicott.
Good afternoon, Chair Barnhart and representatives of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to come and present a little testimony here today. I am Thomas Endicott, managing partner of Sequential Biofuels, and you may know we're the only operating commercial biofuel production facility in Oregon today, waiting for Pacific Ethanol and Cascade Grain to start up their ethanol facilities. Specifically today, I wanted to come in support of HB 2210 and talk about the revenue impact of and the importance of the production tax credits for feedstock that are in this bill, and also that the value that was established by the Oregon Department of Energy and the Governor's Office, which I know you've received that information, that it's really important that on those particular crops, that is the level of the production tax credit. As I recall from the last 5 years of being involved in this discussion around trying to create incentives for a biofuels industry in Oregon, this bill and bills before it in previous legislative sessions, the goals were really two. One was increase opportunities to benefit Oregon farmers and Oregon agriculture, and secondly, and not less importantly, maybe more importantly, increasing opportunities for economic development and jobs in Oregon. So this bill is really about not just when I testified to the Joint Committee Revenue and Energy and Environment, I had said you need a market that's big enough for producers to produce and fill into that market, and we need to make sure that Oregon's benefiting, that those production facilities are here and that they're receiving agricultural crops that are grown in Oregon. So the vision is basically this: build commercial biodiesel or biofuel production facilities, both biodiesel and ethanol, in Oregon and feed them with crops that are grown by Oregon farmers. And I think that production credit is very important there. The renewable fuel standard piece of HB 2210, which was discussed in the previous committee, this will create a big market, but we want to make sure, and I think you will want to make sure, that a significant part of that market is filled with biodiesel and bioethanol that's made in Oregon from Oregon crops. And over the next two biennia, these feedstock producer tax credits at their current levels will allow Oregon producers of grain crops and oilseed crops to compete with producers in the Midwest. And I don't think it's intended that these credits will last forever. There is a lag time for the Northwest to catch up with the Midwest, which has had a soy industry since the 30s, has had a corn industry far before that, and the Alberta, Canada canola industry, which has been around since World War II. So we have a little bit of room to catch up. I also want to make the point, because this is about economic development, as you all know, Oregon has no oil wells. We have no refineries. And yet we spend at least $10 million every day on 6 million gallons of gasoline and diesel fuel. That's 2.2 billion gallons of gas and diesel per year at least $3.3 billion that Oregonians spend on those fuels. And that money basically leaves the state because we don't have oil wells, we don't have refineries. Now, we appreciate receiving that product from elsewhere because it runs the economy, and we need that. However, we're hoping that with this bill, Oregon-made biofuels can provide an opportunity for Oregon to capture an increasing percentage of that money that's spent on transportation fuels every year and circulate that money throughout the economy. And I want to mention Oregon State University economists have said that a dollar that flows to an Oregon company will revolve 2.5 to 3 times through the Oregon economy before it leaves the state, whereas a dollar spent with a company outside of Oregon leaves much more quickly. And just to give you an example here, too, the 140 million gallons of ethanol that would be consumed in Oregon as a result of the renewable fuel standard that's in this bill represents at least $280 million that could flow to Oregon-based companies processing Oregon agricultural products into ethanol in Oregon. Clearly, not only is there benefit of keeping those dollars spent on the transportation fuels here in Oregon, another major impact, and perhaps the largest impact, will be to stimulate the construction and operation of commercial biofuels production facilities in Oregon. And, of course, multi-million dollar projects, production facilities bring jobs and economic development. This has already begun with the Pacific Ethanol plant in Boardman and with the Cascade Grain plant in Clatskanie. Both of these plants will use Midwest corn as their feedstock. So although the industry, the facilities there as industry, will benefit the Oregon economy without a doubt, and that's a good thing, it won't benefit Oregon agricultural growers, those particular facilities. Currently, most of the ethanol in the U.S. is produced from corn, and most of the biodiesel in the U.S. is produced from soy. And in Oregon, we can produce ethanol from wheat, which we grow here. We can produce biodiesel from Oregon-grown canola, which is beginning to be grown here. But in the short term, these Oregon crops are slightly more expensive than corn and soy. And I stress in the short term. Evening the playing field for Oregon producers of these crops is the main purpose for these tax credits in this bill. And let me get just a little more specifically here. As a biofuels producer, we're always caught between the changing prices of commodity grain, which is the main input on one end, and the changing prices of commodity gasoline and diesel fuel on the other end. So it's let me be clear that the price of gas and diesel is driven by crude oil, and these biofuels are direct replacements for gasoline and diesel fuel. So we're very much tied to our ability to fill the market is tied to the changing price of crude oil. So the increasing price of crude oil over the next 5 years will pull gasoline and diesel prices steadily upward. And you can look at national trends of increasing crude oil, and it's steadily upward every year. We saw, I believe, $77 per barrel this last summer, and I would predict that every year we will see a larger spike and a smaller fall, and so the it will increase. And basically, when crude hits around $70 a barrel with the plants that we operate, biodiesel and ethanol become very cost competitive with the gasoline and diesel fuel. So we're trying to get to that point, and that will be the major thing that moves the market, but it's not going to happen quite yet. So as the price of crude oil and the gasoline and diesel go higher, biofuel pricing will keep pace with those, and that will also drive commodity prices for grain and vegetable oil higher, which is good for Oregon growers. But we need to get – we are not at $75 a barrel today, and so we have this bit of a lag. So at a sustained price of $75, which is not that far away, I believe that Oregon grain growers and Oregon biofuels industries then could be more competitive. And that's probably within the next 5 years, might be within the next couple of years. The feedstock producer credits then for grain crops and oilseed are absolutely essential to the production of Oregon-grown biofuels to develop that industry in Oregon, and that the level of these tax credits that have been proposed by the governor's office and the Oregon Department of Energy, we absolutely believe those are the right numbers. And they've moved around a little bit, but these are the right numbers. 5 cents per pound for oilseed, 90 cents per bushel for grain crops. And that gives us the ability to compete with Midwest soy and corn over the next few years and be in a position to really take advantage of locally produced biofuels into the Oregon market as the price of crude oil increases. And I also just want to make a point here, too, which has been made by several farmers to me, that many growers don't have income tax liability. And there is a provision to pass this through. However, the pass-through would be roughly 73% of the total value of the incentive. So this really does have to get back to the grower. And in reality, they're going to see about 73% of this. So wrapping up here, over the next two biennia, these production tax credits will basically act as a hedge. And so for the Oregon growers, it provides a better than average price for their commodity crops when they go to biofuels facilities. They only get that tax credit if their grain goes to an ethanol facility or if their oil seed goes to a biodiesel facility. And then it will also provide the biofuel producer, biodiesel or ethanol, with a negotiated buffer in the short term if commodity grain and vegetable oil prices push beyond a facility's break-even point in the short term. So if grain, and we're seeing this a little bit right now, it's not out of control yet, but as corn prices come up but gasoline prices stay low, that causes problems for the biofuels industry. So this is just enough of a buffer that would keep that solid. And I just also, I included in the packet of information, and I just wanted to make the point here, Kent Madison from Echo, Oregon, who I believe testified previously, he sent me an email and said that he wasn't able to be here, but that he wanted to convey his support for the bill, and from his email here, that HB 2210, as a tool that our state government can use to encourage to make the investment needed to grow the industry and improve our economy while benefiting our environment. As farmers in Oregon, we can't compete the cost of production of farms located in Canada or the Midwestern states today. And so these tax credits would help to bridge that gap. Finally, Oregon is absolutely well positioned to be a leader in the biofuels industry in the long term, and the sooner we begin to develop the industry, the sooner we'll reap those rewards. And the feedstock producer credits at these levels are absolutely important for this to happen. And lastly, as you may know, Minnesota is the shining example of biofuels, both as market and as an economic development tool for that state. In 1987, Minnesota enacted a direct payment program to ethanol producers in that state, and that program remained in effect until 2002. And what they did was they actually paid 20 cents per gallon for ethanol production. There's a long history of that, and they would pay up to $35 million per year. And I included as the last sheet in your packet here, this is a graph from Ralph Grolshin, who's a marketing specialist with Minnesota Department of Agriculture. This is from a study that was done in 2002, when they looked back at the economic impact of the money that they invested in their ethanol program through these direct producer payments. And what that study showed was that from 1990 to 2002, the overall economic impact of their payment program was between 12 and 20 times the amount of money that was invested. And so, as an example there, in 2002, they produced just shy of 600 million gallons of ethanol. They invested $34 million in their payment program, and the economic impact was estimated at $587 million. And so my point in this is, we use a tremendous amount of fuel in this state. It's a leak to our economy. We send it out. We can't replace it all. We could replace some of it, and it could be a very significant economic driver for the Oregon economy. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions? Representative Butler.
Thank you. I just had a question on the page immediately before the Madison email. Mm-hmm. The comment, Tom, that you made there relative to the negotiated buffer between the price of the commodities and the vegetable oil itself. Mm-hmm. Are the grains interchangeable for food consumption and compatible for then also use in production of ethanol or biodiesel?
Well, in this region, the wheat that we would use in an ethanol production facility would be the same wheat that generally is shipped to Asia. Most of that product goes to Asia, is my understanding. Hmm. Soft white wheat.
Okay, so full compatibility with regard to the wheat and the corn?
Corn is a different situation. Corn, there's numbers of different types of corn, and my understanding, and I'm not an expert in this, is that roughly 8 to 10% of all corn production in the U.S. goes to human consumption, and the rest of it is a different type of corn that's largely livestock feed.
Okay, and follow.
And that would be that livestock type of corn would be ethanol production in the Midwest.
Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then on the page immediately before that, the final paragraph there, the issue of the farm tax liability reaping 73% of the value directly of the tax credit itself. You're anticipating some sort of a market for the sale of the tax credits at that point?
Yes.
Why only 73%? Wouldn't they be better negotiated on the open market?
I think that Director Mike Graney might have a better answer for this, and this was based on the business energy tax credit program that when you sell the credit, there's a net present value of money, so a one-time sale in 1 year for the credit, the tax credit that's taken over a five-year period. But I think Director Graney could clarify that.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think that that's probably correct with regard to some of the credits, but the production credit is a year-to-year credit based upon actual production, and it's actually a higher number than 73%. I think the discount comes in the form, and as I recall, it was 25 cents on 35 cents or something like that. With regard to the credit, which is a 28% discount, which would be close to this, but that was a five-year. That was the five-year versus the production credit.
Thank you, Representative.
Yeah, if you'd like clarification, there has been discussion between ODA and Department of Energy that I've been involved in. I'm sure Brent Searle or Director Green.
Well, I think here what we're concerned about is whether we've got the right structure in our bill, and I think you've said that we do.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes.
Other questions for this witness? Thank you very much. I'm very conscious of the fact that Representative Dingfelder has other duties this afternoon. Did you want to be heard now?
I was just here in case you had any questions.
Great. Thank you. Were there others who wanted to testify today on this bill? I think that this will be the end of it today. Gentlemen, come forward. Hi. Please state your name for the record and then give your testimony. We appreciate that.
Mike Noonan, Oregon Wheat Growers. I'm president of the Oregon Wheat Growers League. It's a nonprofit trade association located in Pendleton, Oregon. It represents approximately 4,500 producers.
Excuse me, Mr. Noonan, I think you have distributed your testimony, have you not?
Right.
Everyone should have these pieces here. It would be very helpful to us if you would summarize the main points that you want to make,
right,
and then people can read what you've actually written.
I think the main points that I want to make is that for us, as an industry, we want to be part of the fuel discussion in growing crops, whether it's wheat, canola, whatever it might be. We see an opportunity here as wheat growers to do those things. And canola, as we start to go into growing these crops, if we're going to make changes to go to fuels, we're going to have some kind of infrastructure set up so that we can encourage the production. Not only the production, but also the research involved to get farmers started growing these energy crops. So those are probably the biggest things that we can see. We're looking for 2025, we can really see that the economic advantages for Oregon farmers, but along with that, we also can see that our fuel and fertilizer costs and energy costs are so high that this can help us both control them, and we're in favor of the bill.
Great. Thank you very much. Go ahead, and then we'll have questions for the both of you. Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Carl Strantz. I'm past president of the Oregon Wheat Growers League, and I am currently secretary treasurer of the National Association of Wheat Growers in Washington, D.C., and I'm a farmer in the Klamath Falls area. Corn grain has been a major feedstock for ethanol production in the past, but National Association of Wheat Growers has adopted cellulosic ethanol, and particularly right now from wheat straw, as a source of fuel for cellulosic ethanol. And we encourage the production of the study and progression of that industry moving forward. I think there's a lot of discussion out there that corn may not have a very good conversion to the energy converted to required to grow a bushel of corn converted over to a gallons of ethanol and energy. We feel that cellulosic ethanol is really the future of biofuels, or at least from the National Association's standpoint. So we have a few of our members. One company, Iogen, out of Canada, has looking to grow to put a demonstration plant, and I think that plant, they're looking at Idaho right now for that plant. So also in the President's State of the Union address, very big for the last two years on switchgrass production. Switchgrass is a native grass. It can be grown in areas that are and adapted to different areas. And I think that's where research dollars are very important in the state of Oregon to maybe we can test some of these products. Not only switchgrass, but maybe other varieties of wheat that, you know, maybe we've been trying to grow wheat that has shorter straws, less residue. I mean, maybe there's good yielding wheats out there, good quality wheat that will produce a little bit more straw, which can also be used for the cellulose. So, The economy of the scales of these production facilities is great. If you can have a combination of products that can be used at these sites, it would be more easily attainable for our state. Klamath Basin, for example, is kind of, you know, not a huge farming area, but with wood products, all those types of things, maybe cellulose, you could add to the mix, and it could all be produced in that area. I'd just like to reiterate that the wheat straw is a very good source of the cellulose, which will be broken down into simple sugars, and then those sugars fermented into alcohol to make ethanol. Also, another thing is being from Klamath, and there's a lot of talk about Oasis Project on the Columbia River for more added water. I think assuring that farmers have an adequate supply of water is viable. Is vital to our energy needs and just the future of Oregon agriculture. And I thank you for your time.
Thank you very, very much. One quick thing. This bill that we're talking about today either furthers or at least doesn't impede those issues that you've raised. Am I right about that?
That's exactly right. I think it costs a lot of money to say, like, if we were to bale straw to take to a cellulosic ethanol plant, you know, we'd be nice to get a jump start to have the ability to bale the straw. And also, if we were to convert some of our acres, part of the farm bill discussion is to convert some conservation reserve program acres to where you could produce, say, a type of grass, a grass that you could harvest and continue to keep its environmental benefits and also wildlife benefits, and also harvest the grass for the biofuels. Any assistance we could get with tax incentives for equipment production, and then also the storage of these products, say, like, if whether it be canola or if you needed sheds to store the straw, though that's not as important in, you know, in the desert side of the valley. Because we are just going to be growing cellulose, we are not necessarily going to be growing quality hay, and so cellulose is the game.
Thank you very much, Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really appreciate that both of these folks that have come forward, and Carl has introduced a new concept, and that is that maybe the federal government could participate with us on some of this by allowing us to use those CRP lands and converting them into a new method of producing the biofuels. I just want to ask one question that I am concerned about relative to the conversion of crops, and this probably is more along the Pendleton area with the Wheat Growers League coming out of the Pendleton area. Is there a potential that we will have so much demand on Oregon feedstocks for these kinds of operations that we eventually and trying to conserve and make sure that we're not using the fossil fuels to bring in the other kinds of things, so that we're trying to produce it here? Is there a potential that we could actually interrupt the food supply that Oregon is accustomed to receiving over the rail and the other methods, and actually driving up the cost of our food supplies, and particularly to the Pendleton Mills and those folks there that have a large stock of what's going on, but then that you'd have to go to the Palouse or other places to bring that in, thus running up the cost and the energy cost of the basic food stocks which we have to provide for human consumption in order to keep the fossil fuel uses at a minimum to kind of jockey the books, if you will.
Well, that's something that I was talking about yesterday. We do got a situation here is what's going to be the balance of renewable fuels. And right now you got the corn crop in particular at 20% being utilized. In the next 2 years to 3 years, it's going to be up to 33% of the total U.S. corn crop. And then you start to think about if there's any weather-related activity. Okay, right now you got $4 corn and $5 wheat. That works right now with shipping. I guess my point is, at some point, there's going to have to be balance addressed. Will it be 10%? We're definitely moving towards that percentage. And as far as your question about, I think you're going to see food prices go up if it goes too high. And then the last part about locally at Pendleton, I don't think that would be an issue, not for for the long term. You know, they'll be able to secure the grain that they need to run the local facility.
I might add that approximately 25% of the land is in conservation reserve program in the wheat growing areas, the dryland wheat growing areas. The price of wheat's been very low. Now some of that land is converted to CRP because of environmental benefits, that is the reason it is converted. Lately, the price of wheat's been so low that people are actively pursuing putting their land in conservation reserve program. I'm not sure that all of that land is as environmentally sensitive as it maybe warrants being out of production. So I think as far as the cellulosic ethanol using switchgrass or a type of grass that will grow in eastern Oregon, I don't think that that's going to interrupt the food chain. And then also the wheat straw would be the as long as you could keep your conservation conservation plans intact without taking off too much of that straw, we would not disrupt the food supply in that regard.
I think that's all very, very important, and particularly the introduction of the idea of the additional farmland that would be necessary, particularly there in the Columbia Basin, to try and make this work, because that's really the breadbasket of Oregon.
Thank you.
Not to say anything bad about the Klamath Basin.
Thank you. Are there other questions for this panel? Thank you, gentlemen. We appreciate your testimony today. Is there anyone else who wants to testify on this bill? Next time we open the work session, it will be to work the bill. Thank you very much. So we'll close the work session on House Bill 2210.
When do you anticipate the amendments to this bill, Mr. Chair?
We're hoping for them on Monday. I'm getting a nod, so Monday. All right, we're hoping for them on Monday. Everyone knows our problem with the bottleneck in our processing of bills. We have a production bottleneck as well, Representative Butler. I should mention that Mr. Graney has complied with our request for dividing up his earlier memo and actually amplifying on it, and that's material you have at the podium here, and I would commend it to your weekend reading, so you'll all be ready for voting on the amendments and on the bill. On the three bills on Monday. Hopefully we'll have them ready by then. We're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2235. Do we have a list of a sign-up sheet for that? Okay. You want to give us a summary?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2235 is the federal reconnect bill. It changes Oregon's date reference for statutes pertaining to the definition of S-corporations. It changes the date reference of the definition of Internal Revenue Code to the Federal Internal Revenue Code as amended and in effect on December 31st, 2006. It lists federal legislation that is affected by the act. Provides a mechanism for a taxpayer to have interest or penalties canceled for deficiencies that are attributable to the federal law connection changes in the act. It specifies that if a refund is due a taxpayer for a tax year beginning before January 1, 2007, due to any retroactive treatment from these federal tax law connection changes, then the refund will not be paid with interest. Clarifies that the taxpayers must file an amended return for changes in Oregon's law due to these
federal tax law changes for tax years before January 1, 2007. It allows the Department of Revenue to make changes to tax returns that do not file amended returns and takes effect 90 days after the end of the legislative session. And there is a draft revenue impact with a minimal impact, and that is largely due to Oregon's permanent connection to the federal definition of taxable income, the so-called rolling reconnect. So there are just a couple of minor changes that would produce a minor revenue loss, and mainly they pertain to connections to the earned income credit. Another note to mention, recent disconnect from the federal law, last session, the Assembly disconnected with respect to qualified production activities and is currently scheduled to disconnect from subsidy payments made to employers through the Medicare prescription Part D program.
Thank you very much.
Let's look at our list here. Who should we take care of? These are the guys who...
All right. Let's hear first from Mr. Spaulding, Mr. Crone, and Mr. Karras? Rob Douglas. Sorry.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rob Douglas, representing the Oregon Society of Certified Public Accountants. I've had the pleasure of representing CPAs in the state since 1978. As many of you are aware, OSCPA has consistently lobbied the Legislative Assembly in favor of what we call tax conformity. It is in that spirit that we are here today to present the committee with changes in the federal tax code, an analysis of those changes, and our suggestion is how Oregon should address those federal changes. With me today is Kim Spaulding, Bruce Crone, and Bob Karras, who will be providing the technical details on tax conformity. Thank you.
Thank you. Sorry, Mrs. Spaulding, I couldn't read your first name. It looked like a Z rather than an I. I apologize.
No, that's okay. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm Kim Spaulding, and I'm here with the Oregon Society of CPA and the Legislative Analysis Committee. And what we've done is put together a booklet for you. Do you all have a copy? And what that contains is all the federal legislation that has been enacted during 2005 and 2006. If you open the second page, it provides you a list of the federal acts that are contained in the booklet. The first page before that gives you a summary of what Mr. Douglas just gave to you, the history of what our team has provided to you over the years, and the two acts that the revenue staff described as being currently disconnected from. So currently, the Oregon is what we call permanently tied, and that's for taxable income items only. And so this booklet is divided up into different sections. And Section A contains the federal legislation that is what we call connected to, or what Oregon is connected to. So typically what we've done is talked about those items first. The tab B are items that don't pertain to Oregon or that Oregon has its own rules. And tab C are items that are disconnected currently because Oregon has a tie date that is date specific. And so it is currently not automatically connected, but they contain items that you probably want to connect to. So we recommend going through tab A first, which again would give you an idea of the different items that the federal legislation has enacted and that Oregon is automatically tied to. So if it's okay with you, that's the way we'll proceed?
Please.
Okay. So going to page one behind tab A, we'll talk first about the Energy Tax Incentive Act of 2005. And I'll kind of read through these section by section, and if you have questions, feel free to stop me while I'm going through them. Act Section 1304 discusses electric cooperatives, and there's an income tax exemption that's provided for electric cooperatives if at least 85% of its income consists of amounts collected from its members with the sole purpose of providing services to those members. And this act eliminates the sunset provision, and so they will continue to apply after 2006. Act Section 1305 allows a taxpayer to elect to defer a gain from a qualifying electric transmission transaction ratably over 8 years to the extent that the proceeds are reinvested in exempt utility property. And this act extends the sunset date to dispositions before 2008. Section 1308 changes the depreciable life from 20 to 15 years for any personal property used in the transmission of electricity for sale. 1309 changes the amortization period from 60 to 84 months for certified pollution control facilities. I'm going to talk a little bit in between here about the Gulf Opportunity Act because it was enacted after this act and the Katrina Act that we'll cover later, and the provisions are very similar. So on page 15, you don't have to go there, but the Gulf Opportunity Act contains a technical correction with regards to this act, Section 1309. I'm just going to mention that, and I won't cover that again. Act Section 1310 on page 2 contains modifications to special rules for nuclear decommissioning costs and changes the amount of funds the taxpayer can set aside over the life of the plant. It will be the total expected future decommissioning costs on a net present value basis, and those costs are deducted ratably over the remaining useful life of the plant. Section 1323 provides taxpayers with an election to treat 50% of the costs of qualified refinery property as a current deductible expense. The remainder is depreciated under normal depreciation rules. 1324 is a deduction for capital costs incurred by small refiner cooperatives in complying with the EPA sulfur regulations. And the act allows small business refiners to elect to deduct up to 75% of qualified costs in complying with these rules. It also allows cooperatives that incur these costs an election to pass it through to its patrons. Act Section 1325 changes the life for depreciation purposes from 20 to 15 years for any natural gas distribution pipelines. So are you all on board yet?
Well, riveting.
Yeah, very exciting. Act Section 1326, the taxpayers and IRS have litigated the depreciable lives of natural gas gathering lines. Some courts have ruled that they're 15-year depreciation and others 7. So this act specifies that natural gas gathering lines will be depreciated over 7 years. Act Section 1327 relates to arbitrage rules and that they will not apply to prepayments for natural gas. And this provision creates a safe harbor exception to the general rule that tax-exempt bond finance prepayments violate the arbitrage restrictions, and therefore the bonds are tax-exempt. 1329 relates to geological and geophysical expenditures. Generally, under existing law, these expenses incurred in connection with oil and gas properties must be capitalized into the property. And the Act provides that such costs are allowed as amortization over a 24-month period. 1331 relates to energy-efficient commercial buildings deduction, and instead of depreciation, the Act allows a current deduction for property placed in service before 2008. The deduction is limited to 1.8 times the square footage of the building. There's also a technical correction related to this Act on page 15 of Act Section 402. Act Section 1348 at the bottom of page 3, it sunsets the deduction for basically hybrid vehicles and now provides a credit for purchases after 2005. Section 1351 is an expansion of the research credit and expands the definition of qualified expenditures to include amounts paid to an energy research consortium. And the definition of this is complex, but it's generally a tax-exempt entity organized and operated primarily to conduct energy research in the public interest. Section 1363, the Act modifies the recapture rules to provide that all 197 intangibles sold in the same transaction will be treated as one asset for purposes of applying the recapture rules. If you guys want an explanation about any of this, feel free to ask. Okay, on to the Safe, Accountable, Flexible, Efficient Transportation Equity Act. We like to call it a safety lou. And I'm not going to try and say the exact section number, but the first one. This act creates a new type of tax-exempt facility eligible to be financed with tax-exempt bonds. The new type of tax-exempt facility bonds finance certain projects for surface transportation, international bridges and tunnels, and facilities to transfer freight from trucks to rail. Katrina. So this is what I was referring to earlier. The Katrina Act also ties in closely with the Gulf Opportunity Act, so I will be referring to both of them in this next section. Gulf Opportunity, we like to call the GO Zone. Act Section 101, the Act allows an individual who received qualified Hurricane Katrina distributions from retirement plans to make one or more contributions as a repayment of that distribution and have it be treated as an eligible transfer. It also allows an income exclusion of a qualified distribution to be spread over a three-year taxable period. And
excuse
the
me, are these likely to affect very many Oregonians?
No. So
why don't we skip over the ones that I'm sure there are a lot of people in Louisiana and the South Coast that who took money out of their accounts in order to deal with emergencies and now would like to put it back, but I doubt that will affect very many of us, and perhaps we could skip through this to the ones that are likely to have an impact in Oregon.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you have part your residences. A number of people from Louisiana moved up to Portland, and they will be filing federal returns, reporting income and deductions in Louisiana and in Oregon. So
but
it is a limited number.
And Mr. Chairman, you can just be aware that there are a number of tax incentives and things to assist those people, and that Oregon does tie to those provisions. So
right.
They are here for your reading, and we'll go ahead and skip over
those. So if those people are now Oregon residents, they potentially could file full year or part year Oregon tax returns, upon which they would be entitled to a state tax deduction as well. Is that right?
Not necessarily a state tax deduction, but the federal provisions that allow them to take advantage of these benefits. In terms of the retirement plan distributions and recontributions and
right.
a lot of assistance.
I realized I used the wrong language to a CPA. It reduces the taxes they have to pay in Oregon.
So we can skip Katrina and the GO Zone then?
Well, I would prefer doing that unless the committee really wants to go into those issues.
No, that's good.
Turn to page 17.
There are a couple of items, excuse me,
go ahead.
In here that are not necessarily Katrina-related, so I'm just going to mention...
That would be good.
On page 6, there was a temporary suspension of the limitation on charitable contributions, and this allowed taxpayers to deduct charitable contributions up to the full amount of their income. You may recall that there was a period when we could deduct more than the typical 15% limitation. And there's some different mileage rate reimbursements, some enhanced charitable contribution deductions that were expanded beyond C corporations. Those could potentially apply here, but were made with regards to the hurricane relief.
Right.
And debt forgiveness, personal casualty losses, a lot related to bonds. I'm on page 10 now. Again, another tax deferral on property in the hurricane zone. Same thing with page 10 and 11. A lot of various tax benefits for those. Section 179 and 50% bonus depreciation and expensing provisions. It's all related to... Yeah, all right, I'm done. Thank you. Page 17.
Jeez. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Robert Karras. I'm a CPA in Clackamas, Oregon. And I had hoped for a longer period of time that Ms. Smalding would be testifying. Unfortunately. No. I'm beginning on page 16 of your notes, with the Tax Increase Prevention and Reconciliation Act of 2005. The enactment date of that was May 17, 2006. Act Section 101 of that Act talks about increased expensing for small business, and this relates to what we CPAs refer to as the Section 179 expensing. Presently, the limitation on writing off Section 179 property is $100,000, and it was scheduled to go down in 2008, and that now that $100,000 adjusted, I believe, for inflation, is now good for until 2010. Act Section 103 deals with controlled foreign corporations. Some provisions dealing with controlled foreign corporations, basically subpart F of the federal tax code, imposes immediate taxation on foreign subsidiaries of certain U.S. shareholders, even if they don't get their money back. And there's a bunch of very, very narrow and very intricate rules in subpart F. But suffice it to say that certain rules regarding qualifying insurance companies and foreign personal holding companies engaged in banking, those rules, which are actually beneficial rules, have been scheduled to expire in 2007, and now they are extended until 2009. There's also a new, what's called a CFC on page 17, CFC look-through rule exception from subpart F. Apparently some multinational organizations had been employing a tax avoidance scheme, and this is an attempt to close that loophole. This is effective for tax years, but only for a limited time. It's effective for tax years 2006 through 2008. Act Section 201 on page 17 talks about environmental settlement funds. And basically, an environmental settlement fund is a mandatory set-aside of a taxpayer's assets in order to satisfy future and present claims arising from various kinds of things related to property damage. In the past, settlement funds, the income that's earned in assets placed in the settlement fund was taxable to the person who contributed that money, and now under this law, those funds are now treated as beneficially owned by the U.S. government, and so are not subject to federal income tax. Act Section 202 talks about the corporate spinoff area. Code Section 355 definition. Basically, it's this new law makes it easier for corporate groups, which use a holding company structure, to engage in tax-free corporate divisions. This is done by applying the active trader business test to the relevant affiliated group instead of applying it narrowly. It's applied to the entire group, making it easier for you to do a tax-free spinoff if what you have is a holding company. This was scheduled to expire in 2010, but it was made permanent later on in another act that I'm going to be covering. It was made permanent in 2006. On page 18, Act Section 203 talks about loans financed with veterans mortgage bonds. Basically, the new law changes eligibility requirements for loans financed with qualifying veterans mortgage bonds issued by, among other states, Oregon, which repeals the requirement that veterans have to have served before January 1977. The old rules, a lot of veterans were cut out from eligibility for these special mortgage bonds, low-interest mortgage bonds, and now what we're doing here is the federal government is embracing a larger group of veterans. Along the same line, Act Section 203 increases the state limitation on veterans mortgage bonds. The federal government had capped the amount of veterans mortgage bonds that could be issued, and now the volume limits are going up gradually over a period of years to $25 million for the state of Oregon. Here again, this was scheduled to expire at some point in the future, but a later act made this provision permanent.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
These two provisions, if I understand them correctly, take care of an issue that the Veterans Affairs Committee in the last legislature was very interested in, and that was to allow the Veterans Department to get back into the business of mortgage lending to veterans and at hopefully better interest rates than are available in the commercial market. Is that the import of these two provisions that you've just referred to?
I would certainly think so. The second one, the 203 provision, raises increases the pool of money available to do veterans loans, and the 203A piece lowers the eligibility standards so that more veterans can then come in and tap those funds for home loans.
Thank you. We were effectively unwinding our veterans loan program because nobody was eligible to borrow anymore.
Well, I can see why.
And this, if I understand these two provisions correctly, this corrects that by allowing current veterans, more recent veterans, to qualify because who served after 1977 and later, which I assume would include people who are coming out of the service now.
Chair Barnhart, that's exactly true. As far as I understand, this would relate to the Gulf War veterans and even the ones coming home from Iraq.
Contrary to pages 5 through 16, this may have a big impact in Oregon.
But a non-tax one.
Correct. Okay. Thank you. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, I think we did, as a state, actually modify who were veterans and non-veterans in the last session.
Yes.
To identify that for Oregon purposes.
Right, we were anticipating
which, this. Which the federal has now done.
Right.
But with regard to expanding the amount by $25 million in each of the states that these folks can borrow, recognize that we have a huge pool, some of it paying off all of the time, and now this gives you an additional $25 million. That'll take care of just a couple of weeks' worth of the borrowing at the rate that we've got right now for the veterans. So it is recognized, and I think we said this in an earlier meeting, that second only to the U.S. government, Oregon's veterans program is the largest, was at one time, the largest home loan lender in the United States.
Yes, and we've been subtly unwinding that position ever since we made the last of those loans, and now we're going to be able to make some new ones, is what it amounts to. Thank you, Representative Butler. Please go ahead.
Certainly. Thank you. That's very interesting information. I wasn't aware that these kinds of things were taking place. It's great.
Well, and the point that Representative Butler made is that Oregon changed its rules in anticipation of this possible change. We were hoping we were going to get it. So we're now ready to go ahead, I think. We'll ask the treasurer later about that, but I think we're ready to go ahead with reopening that program.
Because all the pieces are in place.
Yes.
Okay. Getting towards the bottom of page 18, we're talking on Act Section 204 with the capital gains treatment regarding self-created musical works. The new law provides that... provided that the
I think our page numbers are different.
Yeah. Oh, are they?
Oh, we're actually on page 19.
Oh, my.
It's okay.
That's all right. We're doing fine. When you say one number, we're going to add one to that.
Anyone have a sharp implement? I need
it. We can handle it.
We'll figure it out.
We can figure it out.
Accountants just love to have fun.
Your Representative Butler, you're absolutely correct. In any event, on page 19, the new law provides that at the election of the taxpayer, the sale or exchange of a musical composition or copyright in a musical work is treated as a sale or exchange of a capital asset. The new law also talks about charitable donations and cranks that back a little bit and says that if you are going to donate those assets to a charitable organization, then you're still limited to the adjusted basis of the property, which is the rule that has traditionally been in place. That was supposed to expire in 2010, but 2006 legislation also made this provision permanent as well. The reason why we're bringing this before you, Oregon doesn't differentiate between capital gains and ordinary income, but there may be narrow situations where treating a certain type of income as capital gain income may alter a person's taxable income. So a person being an individual or a corporation. So we feel that this is an adjustment here because it really does affect the calculation of taxable income on which Oregon would be assessing income tax. On page 19, oh my gosh, my notes are on the wrong book. 207A talks about 5-year amortization for the expenses of creating or acquiring musical compositions or music copyrights. Basically, instead of being stuck with the cost recovery principles established under Code Section 263A, we now have these individuals and these corporations now have an elective 5-year amortization period for musical works and copyrights. Act Section 208 deals with the allowance of additional $10 million of capital expenditures for small issue bonds. Basically, these are private activity tax-exempt bonds, and the cap used to be $1 million. Now, the 2004 Jobs Act expanded an additional $10 million allowance for all small-issue bonds, but that was scheduled to expire, and now the new law not that it was scheduled to expire, but it was not scheduled to come into being. That provision was not scheduled to come into being until 2009, probably out of budget balancing concerns. And now this new law accelerates the application of that limitation to December 31st, 2006. So basically, the $10 million for small issue bonds now is going to be available for 2007 and forward. Act Section 209 deals with below market loans to qualifying to continuing care facilities. Basically, the tax law doesn't appreciate it when people make loans that are below a certain target rate of interest and changes the ground rules for those kinds of loans. This legislation basically makes it okay for certain people to loan money when it's their money and it's their retirement home, to loan money to continuing care facilities. If there's a give and take involved with the parties, this rule was scheduled to expire, but is now a permanent rule after 2006 law changes. Act Section 501 deals with the application of the earnings stripping rules to partners, which are corporations. The earnings stripping rules. They limit the deductibility of interest paid to certain related parties. Related parties with particularly bad balance sheets or particularly bad income statements, and the whole idea is that there's a game, and I'll be frank, that game is somewhat beyond me, but there's a game that can be played by certain corporations in situations like this that is a tax avoidance type of a technique. And this act that we're dealing with right now basically expands the scope of those rules and allows the IRS to look through a corporation to the partnerships that it is a partner in and apply the debt ratios and apply the interest expense loads of the partnerships to and collapse that into the parent corporation, the owning corporation.
And the point being to increase taxable income.
Exactly. This was originally a regulation that was proposed by the IRS, and the Congress liked it so well they decided this to codify it.
I think it's just after you and I, Phil.
Yeah.
I don't think so. Unless you have a lot more corporations and partnerships than you know about.
Act Section 503 deals with large extended oil-producing companies. It's another revenue-raising measure. Formerly, there was a two-year amortization period available for geological and geophysical expenditures, capital expenditures. That this act extends that two-year amortization period now to 5 years, but only for certain major integrated oil companies. These are oil companies that have worldwide production of at least 500,000 barrels for the tax year, gross receipts in excess of $1 billion, and which have at least a 15% ownership interest in a crude oil refinery. So these are the large-scale oil refining organizations. Act Section 507 deals with another aspect of Code Section 355. It says that the act denies Code Section 355 treatment to a transaction if either the distributing or the controlled corporation is a, quote, disqualified investment corporation immediately after the transaction, and any person that did not hold at least 50% of the voting power of the stock before the transaction now holds a 50% greater interest immediately after the transaction. Act Section 508, at the bottom of page 21, it talks about loan and redemption agreements, requirements rather, on pooled financing. The Act imposes new requirements on pooled financing bonds as a condition of tax exemption. And there's a bunch of detail here, which I'm sure that is...
Bob, can I ask a question about 507? Is that aimed...
Thank you.
I beg your pardon, Mr. Chair. Bob, is that 507 aimed at up-reading? Is that what that's about? Could that be used there?
Excuse me, would you repeat the question?
On Section 507, would that be aimed at those corporations which created their own REITs and moved property to their own REITs, or is that where they controlled 50% or greater of the investment immediately after the transaction if they were creating their own for tax avoidance purposes?
Representative Butler and members of the committee, I'm not sure that I really am familiar enough with the background behind this.
Okay, that's fine. Thank you very much.
Legislation.
The point of these, of course, is that they're designed to prevent people from avoiding paying taxes that they really ought to pay.
Exactly.
That's about all I can get out of these, and that's probably all I need to know.
these are going to be complex transactions that are going to be undertaken by large organizations. And again, the part about where someone moves from a less than 50% position to a greater than 50% position immediately after the transaction seems to me that there's a tax avoidance goal going on there.
Mr. Chair, if I could just say, you know, some of these, as we go through and talk about minerals and those kinds of things, oil production and large barrels of oil and integrated oil companies, those kinds of things, you'd think that those wouldn't apply to Oregon. But however, now that we've got a large sales apportionment factor, those folks are selling, and 100% of the sales in Oregon count towards their overall apportionment formula.
Right.
And so we're actually, this, while it doesn't affect, we don't have any refineries in Oregon, but it affects those folks that are coming to sell their oil in Oregon. Thank you.
The Exxons and Chevrons.
Yep. Right. They're all included right here now.
So we're a player in that market, even though we don't have a drop of oil in the ground. Refined.
But the previous testimony under 2210, we might be in the oil production, some kind of oil production business at some point in the future.
I hope we can get up to 500,000 barrels.
Well, we sure hope so, too. Please proceed.
Yes, sir. Act Section 510 relates to what's called the notorious kiddie tax. Under previous law, a child who's under the age of 14, their unearned income would be taxed to their parents. Now that child can be up to 18 years of age and still have mom and dad pay taxes on the child's unearned income. Act Section 512 talks about conversions to Roth IRAs. In the past, there have been income limitations on conversion of traditional IRAs to Roth IRAs. If your adjusted gross income was high enough, you'd be restricted from making a conversion of your traditional IRA. But this that income limitation is now gone. There are special rules about conversions occurring in 2010, which I would just as soon skip. Let's see. Act Section 513 talks about the repeal of FISC and ETI binding contract relief. The Act repeals the binding contract exceptions to the repeal of the Foreign Sales Corporation provisions and the repeal of the extraterritorial income exclusion. This is effective for tax years beginning after May 17, 2006. Act Section 515, modification of exclusion for citizens living abroad. U.S. residents who live abroad and earn income overseas have an annual exclusion. That $80,000 annual exclusion is indexed, or is going to be indexed beginning in 2008, and this act accelerates the date when indexing begins to 2006, thereby, in essence, excluding a greater amount of income for those taxpayers. My testimony continues with the HEROES Earned Retirement Opportunities Act. There's only one section to this act. It was enacted in May 29, 2006. IRA contributions by members of the armed forces with combat zone income. Combat zone income of military personnel is not taxable, but this act allows such individuals to count that income anyway in determining the amount of their IRAs that they'd like to, IRA contributions that they'd like to be able to make and deduct. And that's the end of my testimony. I turn it over to my colleague, Bruce Kroon.
Chair Barnhart and members of the committee, I have the exciting Pension Protection Act area, which runs for the next 17 pages. This morning I did a read-through, and I was able to get through within an hour with a good strong cup of coffee, so you might be forewarned.
Mr. Chair, question.
Representative Olson.
Bruce, are you suggesting that we go ahead and get a cup of coffee right now?
Well, I'm expecting to see a cup of coffee during the course of the
hearing. I think it's important to note that we have about 22 minutes left in our in our hearing today, and I think it would be very beneficial for the committee to understand the changes that are likely to be of significance to us here, if you can extract them. I don't know whether you can or not.
I could spend 30 seconds with each title. No?
I don't. It may not be possible to do that.
Okay.
But if
I would like to go to the areas, because this Pension Act started as a pension reform bill.
Yes.
And then there were a number of individual provisions that were added at the end. So it became not a pure pension reform bill, but a kind of an omnibus bill. and there are a number of provisions that affect charitable contributions, et cetera.
Uh-huh. We should have invited Representative McPherson to this meeting today. I didn't realize we were going to be in his area of expertise.
Okay.
Our employment benefits lawyer.
Okay.
Yeah. Go ahead.
So you want me to skip to the individual section, or just cover this very briefly?
I think it would be useful if we had an idea of what Congress had in mind.
Okay.
And if you could give us a summary, that would be probably most beneficial. And I'd ask the committee to go ahead and read the individual provisions and get back to you with questions about particular areas if they had some.
Okay, that'll work. The Pension Protection Act was, the purpose of it was to protect the pensions of current and future retirees. As you all know, the pension, the defined benefit pension plan system has been in trouble in this country for a number of years, especially in the airlines and the bus companies, and now some of the old blue-collar industries in the Midwest. And so this is Congress's attempt to force these companies to upgrade the funding. And so Title I, for instance, raises the standards and the rules for a plan to remain tax qualified. And it's important to remember that once it loses its qualification, it becomes a disqualified plan with severe repercussions to the companies making the contributions. They're no longer tax deductible, and it affects the benefits that the recipients have. Now, Oregon is long tied to the federal definition of what constitutes a tax qualified plan, and so it's important for Oregon to stay in conformity in this area, because otherwise you have a plan that's maybe disqualified for federal purposes and qualified for Oregon and vice versa. And it would be essentially a compliance nightmare. So continuing, Title II sets up the new funding rules for multi-employer plans. They're a little different from the single employer plans.
Mm-hmm.
Title III deals with the interest rate assumptions. They've been using the Treasury rate, which is a low rate, which would require a lower funding amount, and they're now required to upgrade to a higher interest rate, which forces them to make larger annual contributions. The next section in Title VII, qualified retirement plans may not discriminate against employees on age. So once again, there's a requirement in order to remain qualified that they have to not have discriminatory language. Title VIII, changes to the deduction limitations. Now employers maintaining single employer defined benefit plans will have to make a minimum contribution. Title VIII, Act Section 803. If an employer has both a defined contribution and a defined benefit plan, there are limits to the amount that can be contributed to both plans, and they have to be synchronized. Act Section 811 on the next page. There are a number of pension changes that were made permanent. There was a tax bill in 2001, the acronym was EGTRA, which provided for increases in the limits of deductions to retirement plans, options to treat elective deferrals as after Roth IRA contributions. They provided for catch-up contributions for people that are 50 or over, and they provide a system to roll over retirement plans and IRA distributions to allow greater portability of pension plans. These are now permanent, so they don't sunset at 2010 anymore.
Right.
Title VIII deals with improvements on the portability, distribution, and contribution rules.
You know, I think one of your sentences early on in your testimony probably was the one that we needed to hear. Two sentences, one that in which you said that the purpose of these acts were to reform the way in which these pensions were handled by the companies. Of course, we were all aware from the news of how many companies have either defaulted on their pensions or closed their pension funds or removed funds from their pensions, which in fact needed to be there from an actuarial point of view to fund them. I think we're aware of those kinds of things, and so they're important in that respect. The other thing you told us, which was crucial, I think, is that Oregon needs to stay connected in order to avoid a nightmare. And I don't think anyone on the committee wants a nightmare. Given the time that we have, I would appreciate it if we could look at recommendation C because that those are the areas which in which your comments are probably the most significant for the committee. And then if people have particular questions about these pension areas the recommendations in which you believe there are no changes are necessary under Section B, we can get back in touch with you, or ultimately we can schedule another time for you to finish with those sections. I think that would probably be the best use of our time for the next 15 minutes if we were to move directly to C. And I apologize for not having enough time to go over all of these provisions with you today.
It's fine with me, sir.
Thank you.
I'll now turn it back to Kim.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we'll turn to page 71. This is a Gulf Opportunity Act change which allowed for an extension of time to file the various types of tax returns. Oregon's tied to that. The filing dates is date specific, so in order to conform with these, you'll need to make a change to roll that date forward. Act Section 201B allows the Secretary the authority to make adjustments in applying the federal laws to ensure that taxpayers don't lose any deductions or credits by way of changing their filing status as a result of having to be relocated as a result of the hurricane. The dependency status is another example where we would need to change the date connection. It doesn't automatically tie.
I just had a quick question, Mr. Chair, for staff. Chris, these are incorporated in the House Bill 2235. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay,
that's
good. Thank you very much.
So we're actually talking about House Bill 2235.
Yeah, this is
okay. So we're finally to the bill. Great. Thank you. Go ahead.
On page 72, Act Section 201C, the federal law provides a refundable earned income credit for the low-income taxpayers, and the Katrina Relief Act allows taxpayers affected by the hurricane to elect to calculate earned income credit using their earned income from the prior year. So they would not be adversely affected and unable to claim the credit just by way of their lower income that year. Oregon provides an earned income credit based on the federal credit, and so we would need to change the tie date for that in order to conform to that new calculation. Act Section 302 provides an election to treat combat pay as earned income for purposes of the earned income calculation. The combat pay is currently exempt from taxation, but now they can elect to include that, which would allow them to claim a higher credit. And that would be the same change that would need to happen on this as the other one in terms of a date tie. So, thank you. That's the end of my testimony.
My testimony picks up with the Pension Protection Act of 2006, and Act Section 864 talks about pension exam proctors as independent contractors, and the law specifically applies to individuals who serves as proctors for college entrance and placement examinations. And the reason for putting this into recommendation C was, if nothing else, to call the committee's attention to the fact that that Oregon and federal law regarding who is an independent contractor and who is an employee still differs, despite the strenuous efforts of a team of individuals from different industries and different special interest groups, attorneys, accountants. Members of the state government had all worked together on this, and they were still unable to do that. One of the things that the OSCPA always harps about is conformity, and this is one area where taxpayers, employers, could be adversely affected, where the definition of some of their workforce for federal purposes differs from the definition of that workforce of that same individual, that same workforce for state purposes. The next provision in the C's is under the Tax Relief and Health Care Act of 2006. Act Section 106 allows basically what it does is just extends the Act Section 302 that Kim was just talking about. We have an extension now to December 31st of 2007 of that provision. Act Section 407 is not something that that Oregon needs to consider but might want to, and that is that the federal government is now imposing a penalty of $5,000 on specified submissions. And the type of submission that we're talking about are requests for hearings, applications for installment payments of tax liabilities, and so forth. frivolous submissions include those specifically listed by the Secretary of the Treasury to be frivolous or which reflect a desire to delay or impede the administration of the federal tax law. This is basically saying, the federal government saying that they're tired of people asserting the gold standard, for instance, as an argument for not having to pay their income taxes. And that is the end of my...
So one presumes they should be required to pay the $5,000 in gold in that case.
Well, certainly that would be appropriate.
That would be appropriate. Thank you.
Silver notes certificates.
Silver note certificates, right. Thank you. Go ahead.
Okay, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm covering this recommendations D. And the recommendations D are federal changes that are mandated, and they affect the states. It's the federal government reaching out and saying, this is how you will treat these items. The first is H.R. 4019, State Taxation of Retirement Payments to Non-Resident Partners. And I'll just read this. Retirement income of all retirees, whether they were employees or partners before retirement, will be treated the same for state tax purposes. A number of years ago, pensions were supposed to be taxed by the resident state rather than the non-resident states, and non-resident states didn't like it, and so the federal government stepped in and legislated that the resident state would have the right to tax retirement pay. And this particular treatment was now extended to taxation of retirement payments to non-resident partners. And this was evolved from a court case in New York. And you'll notice that it's effective retroactively for amounts received after December 31st of 1995. And I understand New York is going to contest this, and some other states are looking at contesting it. But essentially, it puts retirement payments to non-resident partners on the same basis as pension payments to ordinary pensioners.
And this is basically a conflict of laws problem, isn't it?
It is.
Several states trying to tax the same income.
That's correct. It's worked its way through the courts, and the federal government stepped in and said, this is how it's going to be. They just legislated this change to it.
Does our law need a change in order to make this effective, or are we just going to comply with it? Shaking to the negative.
I think New York is playing on it, fighting it, but I'm not sure whether Oregon is following the decision or not at this point.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Oregon is mandated to follow this rule at this point. So this is a recommendation D, which is different than the C, which requires a proactive change.
Ah, thank you.
Okay.
That's why it's in D rather than C.
That's correct.
Thank you very much.
The next two items are
Representative Rosenbaum.
Question. Thanks, Mr. Chair. Is this a provision that prevents the state where the payment originates from taxing that income?
It prevents,
as well as the state where the person lives?
It doesn't matter where the income is earned.
Uh-huh.
It's the resident state that has a right to tax it. So a person working, for instance, in California who moves to Oregon and receives a California source pension does not pay tax to California on that pension because he's an Oregon resident,
right,
and vice versa.
Thanks.
The Pension Protection Act of 2006 had a couple items. Act Section 1105, under present law, unemployment compensation payable by a state to an individual generally is reduced by the amount of retirement benefits received by the individual. And this provision amends the code so that the reduction of unemployment compensation payable to an individual by reason of the receipt of these benefits does not apply if the participant rolls it over into another plan. In other words, he doesn't have constructive receipt of the retirement benefits. He's rolled it over into an IRA.
Technical fix.
Basically,
yes.
it's saying...
But it hurts some people if you don't do it.
That's correct.
Yeah.
And it's telling the states that you cannot deny unemployment coverage for this individual because he hasn't constructively received these benefits.
Thank you.
And Act Section 1303 is a rather interesting one. The bill provided a special exception for the general rule that interest on state or local government bonds issued to finance activities of private persons is taxable unless a specific exception applies, and these are private activity bonds. The exception relates to bonds issued prior to May 31st, 2006, to finance the Lake Dorothy Hydroelectric Project to provide electricity to the city of Hoonah, Alaska.
Sounds like a bridge to nowhere to me, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, it does. We thought you'd appreciate this, and that's why we included it here.
Oh, there aren't any for Oregon, though, I take it.
Well, it just says that you can't tax its interest.
Okay.
For the special provision.
All right, we won't. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, may I make a general comment?
Yes, please.
I'd like to just make the observation that currently Oregon is, as we discussed, is tied permanently to the Internal Revenue Code for items of taxable income. In the past, there have been times when we've tied to specific dates, in which case what you would have seen in this booklet are all the A items. They would have been seized because Oregon would have needed to make a proactive change in order to tie to those items. So instead of needing to make a proactive change to those, it's just important to have reviewed them and make sure that you understand what Oregon has adopted by default by tying automatically.
So. Right. Thank you very much. So the committee, if you don't like what Congress did, start looking at A, and we'll change it back and make additional work for our witnesses today.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your efforts and your time, and I'm sure the members of the committee will carefully review the parts of the booklet that you did not have time to go through, so in case they have questions for you. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Butler.
I'd just like to thank this particular group of folks from the OSCPA putting in virtually hundreds of hours of no charge time to bring us this information, as opposed to 99% of all the material that we receive in the various committees. This is not published at any taxpayer expense. The society goes through and works this out specifically for this committee and the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee, so that we'll have access to the most recent documents and data. And it's a great benefit. I'm just really grateful for the proactivity of the OSCPA and the involvement of not just these three folks at the table, but the whole room full of spirits that sit behind them that are not here today, but in spirit only. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Butler. We definitely appreciate the extra effort that the society goes through in preparing this material for us and help to keep us on track as we do our work. Thank you very much.
Welcome.
Are there others who wish to testify on House Bill 2235? Comments among the committee?
Yes,
Representative Berger, and then we'll get to you.
I will be brief because I know time is brief, but I do hope the members of this committee appreciate how complex reconnection is, how important it is, and not only for the work that these folks go through, but for the work that we go through, and then the work that every single individual taxpayer in the state of Oregon goes through, and how important it is that we stay as closely aligned. This is always my mantra here, because every time we get out of this alignment, it has this ripple effect through. We're the full employment committee for CPAs, tax preparers, and folks who have to deal with this. They would rather not have it be any more complex than it already is, and I would tell you that this whole bill and everything we're doing today looks so simple to me compared to what we've been through in the last two sessions. Representative Butler and Representative Olson know that this is a sort of a happy moment. That
well,
this could be.
And 4 years ago, the last time I was on this committee, we had also several nightmares to deal with, and it took weeks. So I certainly agree that the fact that C and D are short is very useful. Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have some questions that I'd like to ask these folks after we've completed. There's some provisions that we're tying to that I think they're very interesting, particularly relating to the pension monies. One federal pension item allowed withdrawal of IRA monies directly into a charitable arrangement so that folks could give more money to the kinds of charities that we're very unique or we're very experienced with in the state of Oregon to help those folks out. And I'd like to just explore some of those ideas on the pension reform, but I'd like to do so privately.
Thank you. We appreciate that very much. Is there anything else today on House Bill 2235? If not, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2235, and having exhausted our agenda for the day, we are adjourned.
Thank you.
Thank you.